Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
A life that has the stories to back it. A life to be proud of. It's a Winchester life.
Yeah, baby. 6'8 Western. Oh, a mule deer, baby, right there.
Tune in every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
Oh, my gosh. Guys, you gotta hear this. Can you imagine shoving Play-Doh down into that hole and pounding it in until I finally got it? So I don't know if I would endorse it. That's actually a pretty good choice, regardless what I say about the 308. You probably are good to 200 with that. So give that a try, but boy, double check it if you can. I am 97 years old. That's off the lands, guys. If you're not hand loaders, what we're talking about is, I don't know if that's accurate either, but actually that happened to my brother one time, legitimately. By the time it goes bang flash, I'm done anyway, and I have never even noticed then. But for hunting, it's just not practical. So we have to sort of strike a balance. And over the decades, the balance seemed to have become... Well, is the, you're going to love this one, the 458 lot, a good all-around hunting cartridge. And somebody's got a tip for helping all of us clean our rifles without ruining our scopes. That's going to be fun. And guess what? I actually helped someone shoot tighter groups. We're going to cover that all on this episode of Ron Spomer Outdoors Podcast. Hi, everyone. Ron Spomer back with you to share some great comments from folks this time and a few pats on the back for actually giving some good advice. Let's start with one of our patrons, Matt. Hi, Ron. I thought you might be interested to hear about my successful Michigan whitetail season. I took a decent-sized Upper Peninsula Ufta buck, a swamp buck, the first with my new Winchester XPR chambered in 350 Legend. I was shooting 155 grain Browning BXR ammunition. The buck was just inside of 100 yards and angled at a more extreme angle than I would have liked. But he was quickly dispatched, or no, but he was quickly disappearing into the brush. My bullet entered between the last two ribs on his right side, and it actually lodged just under the hide on his left shoulder. Normally, I wouldn't take a shot like that with the bullet leaving an exit wound help with tracking, but in this case, it didn't matter because on its way through, it shredded both lungs and he only went about 20 yards. An added benefit was that I could examine the bullet, which had expanded perfectly. Any doubts I had about the 350 are long gone. If any was in the market for a short-range brush-busting cartridge, I wholly endorse it. Well, all right, Matt. I don't know if I would endorse it as a brush-busting bullet. I tend to downplay brush-busting. I got another letter from someone recently about brush-busting bullets, and my main point about it is you really can't depend on bullets to bust brush unless you're shooting perhaps a tank or a howitzer. The thing is, the tougher a bullet is, the heavier the bullet is, the more it can break through brush and tend to go in a straight line. You know, the old physics lesson, an object moving in a straight line tends to remain in motion until acted upon by another force. So when we're shooting bullets, of course, the one force is definitely gravity, which is moving it out of its straight line into an arc falling to the ground. And then wind is moving it one way or another if there's some wind. But branches and other obstructions, they're going to move it too by deflection. So this idea that you're just going to plow through the brush and keep going in a straight line just doesn't work because any bullet is going to be deflected, even a little bit. That's why big, massive bullets still get deflected by the wind. Just the wind, let alone a branch from an oak or a hickory or something. So I discourage trying to shoot through brush and depending on brush busting bullets. I understand the idea of, gosh, if I'm hunting in some pretty brushy woods country, don't I want to be able to get a shot through there in case there's a branch in the way that I didn't even see? And that's a good reason to use a stouter bullet. So yeah, work with heavier bullets and good construction so they don't break apart easily, which would mean, of course, some kind of a controlled expansion bullet. And I really like the copper bullets for hanging in there. But, you know, even those breaking, hitting branches and stuff. I had one time that closed the nose, you know, the hollow nose in, say, a Barnes triple shock or tipped triple shock. That's where the fluids get inside of that hollow and open it up. It's hydrodynamic or hydrostatic opening of that bullet. Hydraulics are doing the work. But if that nose gets pinched shut, yikes. Now, the plastic tips like the TTSX's tipped triple shock, that helps by driving back in and opening things up. It doesn't get blocked by something else, ideally. And those seem to work really well, too. But I just discourage shooting through brush. And I think most of us understand that. We try to pick a nice, clear shot. All right, so this is another patron, Matt, and he says, hey, it makes perfect sense. I am new to these copper bullets, but I'm starting to like them. I could never get them to shoot good until I heard you say that you had to strip the barrel. So I did that, and then I got pretty impressive groups. Not a single hole five-shot group, but half inch. Say, that's pretty impressive. And what I had told Matt is that to get good accuracy out of these all-copper bullets, it seems like you have to clean your barrel down to bare metal if you've previously been shooting standard bullets, gilding metal jacketed bullets. And probably lead bullets as well, if anybody's shooting those. I don't know what it is, but there's just something about that other surface fouling being in your bore that messes up the accuracy from the all-copper bullets. But boy, it seems like once you do that, clean down to bare metal, then start shooting your copper bullets and only shoot copper bullets after that, your accuracy really can improve. And I've had some good half-inch group shooters too. So Matt and I are on the same page on that one. All right, now here's someone who has responded to me and asking about something on the hydrostatic shock. Let's see what he has to say. His name is not given, but he says, I always enjoy your podcast. You're quite patient with some of the questions you get. Well, that's because there, but for the grace of God, go I. I certainly appreciated folks taking me under their wing and telling me what I needed to know and pounding it in until I finally got it. So I'm more than happy to be a little patient with everyone. He goes on, with regard to commentary on hydrostatic shock, I'm with you. I don't think it's a big thing per se. First of all, hydrostatic shock is a misnomer. I agree. It's hydrostatic refers to a stationary column of water in the most basic sense, and it's usually used to describe the pressure exerted by that column of water. Maybe hydraulic shock or supersonic shock are better descriptors of the process. And I agree with that as well. I sometimes will say hydrodynamic shock. I don't know if that's accurate either, but I think it does give a better picture than hydrostatic. Static meaning, like you said, it's just sitting there, pressure. He continues, if a target animal was comprised of 100% water in a closed system, then hydraulic shock might be a factor. That's a good observation. As Angry Sheep correctly stated, water is essentially incompressible. However, most mammals are roughly 60% water, and they're not closed systems, especially when you introduce a bullet hole. They are elastic, and a well-placed bullet is usually going to encounter some highly compressible air and fluids in the thoracic cavity. As can be seen in ballistic gel images, the high-pressure shockwave around a supersonic bullet does displace everything around it for a short distance, creating that temporary wound channel. But that channel closes back to some degree because it's elastic. And it does it quite quickly. I don't think that this phenomenon can be counted on to kill. Perhaps there is some central nervous system shock created by the impact that incapacitates for a time that is akin to, say, an electrical shock. I don't know. With regards to the buzzsaw effect, linear velocity decays at a much higher rate than rotational velocity. However, passing through an animal should have a significant damping effect on rotational velocity as well as forward velocity. So most of us have seen lead core bullets recovered from game with the peeled back copper jackets, still attached charged that look like tentacles, most of which are quite thin and still straight. I would think that if the buzzsaw effect was a thing, it would shear these off with ease. Whew, that's some good detailed stuff this gentleman is really thinking. But I will note this, that I have recovered several all-copper bullets, Barnes, TSX and TTSX and LRX, in which you do see the petals that have expanded off the nose you see those bent significantly. And I showed one, I think, on one of my images, might have been on Facebook recently, and a lot of folks commented on that. And the question is, how many times does this bullet rotate as it's going through an animal? Might have, you know, some of these things launch with 250,000 revolutions per minute, but you have to break that down to seconds for the bullet traveling through an animal, which is like split seconds or something. You twist rate and everything. It basically comes down to you're getting maybe 2 to 3 revolutions of that bullet spinning through the animal. And you'll see that in those ballistic gel videos where they're shooting in slow motion and you see that bullet spinning through that clear gel, you can really see the spin effect. And that's what's bending those petals and causing some of that lateral damage to the tissues. But again, I think it's the part of the bullet that actually touches the tissue that does the significant damage. As this gentleman said, the elasticity of tissues allows them to form out, come bouncing back and recover quite a bit. You know, it's just hard to predict. So don't depend on that kind of thing to do the damage, but good analysis there. All right, let's see what Mike has to say. Neck shots are great when everything is perfect. He has that in quotes, and I agree. Put that in quotes, everything is perfect. Usually isn't. I would add that frangible bullets are great when everything is perfect. I think, Ron, that you are too nice to point out strongly enough that no hunter is perfect and few are even approaching that. I'd say that there are a lot more lousy shots that go hunting each year than good shots. And I mean off of a bench. Some of the hunting excuses that I've heard sound like, I'm a bad shot on paper, but on game, when it counts, I'm good. Do you mean when you're winded, you have buck fever, and you're shooting rapidly from an unstable position? A branch deflected it. Ah, my rangefinder got a bad read. I turned the turret the wrong way. The turret hadn't been returned to zero, and I turned it too far. The bullet didn't open. It opened too much. The bullet failed. The cartridge wasn't strong enough. It was too strong. Oh, so I shoot with my eyes closed. This guy's a riot. As they sing at birthday parties and many more. I've seen these and others right here in the comments for your channel and many others. Come on, guys. It's nearly a year from deer season. Y'all at least have access to paper and pen and pencil. Make your packing list for the next season. And during right after the season or just finished, buy what you need to hunt with right away. Buy a rifle if you need to, so you can buy the ammo between the shortages and then practice. If you have to go to the sight-in clinic the week before season opens, just stay home. You aren't ready. If you pull the trigger on an animal, you just used up your tag. If you don't recover the animal, try a little mayo on the tag to make it easier to swallow. If you didn't do everything to recover that animal, turn yourself in right away to the game warden for impersonating a hunter. If you're offended, these remarks are aimed at you. Ooh, that's tough, Mike. Pretty funny, too. Okay, who's going to argue with Mike on that one? Oh, we've all made excuses like that. The sun was in my eyes. Actually, that happened to my brother one time, legitimately. A buck jumped out of some brush in South Dakota and came running. Oh, gosh, he was shooting, I'm pretty sure, a 30-30 Marlin. At any rate, he threw his rifle up, followed that buck. By the time he got on it, it ran right past the setting sun and just glared his scope out to no man's land. And he missed the shot, obviously. So he was grousing about that, but that's a good excuse. All right, that was fun. All right, let's see what Bob has to say. Oh, hey, this is a tip about protecting your scope from splatter of cleaning solvent. To stop solvent splatter when the brush exits the barrel, put a large cordial bottle over the end of the barrel. Problem solved. Yeah, I've done that in the past, and I should have said something about that in my cleaning videos, Bob. But I just used a liter pop bottle, you know, a Coke or 7-Up or something. Just slide that over the muzzle and then push your materials into that. I kind of got away from it because quite often I would have to remove it and I couldn't get the patch off the end of the jag or the brush more often. Or sometimes a brush will come unscrewed. If you're doing a lot of passes and working that brush, it'll come unscrewed unless you've got a good rod that rotates well and all. But still, it's a great way to collect all that debris and keep it from splattering back in your scope. The other thing, of course, is to cover your scope. And I usually keep some scope covers on the cleaning bench so that I can see those and remember to put them on the scope. But sometimes I get absent-minded or in a hurry and I start cleaning and then I realize that I'm spraying solvent when that bristly brush comes out of the bore. Psh, hits the air, and if there's any air movement, it's going to fly back and get on the lens. And that solvent is not good for high dollar lenses, even the ones that are coated. So good tip, Bob. Thanks for sending that in. This is Imbear or Imbear. I don't like the 308 Winchester either. Ooh, I'm getting some support. But it's getting better the more I use it. With this being said, I will grab my 6.5 Creedmoors anytime I'm shooting way out there versus the 308. When I'm elk hunting, I grab my 30-06 and I run 200 grain Nosler partitions, and I choose that over any 308 load. But for deer hunting, I reach for my 243 Winchester or a 22-250 or the 6.5 Creedmoor or a 7mm 08. This guy sounds like an equal opportunity shooter here. So where does the 308 Winchester fit in? I don't know. I know SWAT around here still uses a 308 Winchester, and I guess that they're great in an AR-10, yet I prefer my 6.5 Creedmoor in an AR-10 and a 308 platform. A guy is getting their feelings hurt because we don't like their favorite cartridge. Just get over it. Boy, you guys are tough today. You're calling everybody out. But, you know, more power to you, Imbear, for having a variety of cartridges that you've worked with and appreciating each of them for what they do. We don't need to be running a cartridge down and saying this is complete garbage. It'll never work. And gosh, I saw a comment just recently, I think it was just today, where some guy said that his friend said the 308 Winchester was only effective to 100 yards, whereas the 270 Winchester was good to 500 yards. Well, I'll support him on that 270 Winchester, but he's way off base on the 308. I mean, that thing is still delivering more than 1,500 foot-pounds of energy at 300 yards with most 150 grain bullets. Come on, that's plenty enough energy to get the job done. And the drops aren't bad out there at all. It's probably dropping only 2 inches more than that 270. So I just, you know, it's great to always pick your favorite cartridge and then support it and tease your friends and all. But let's not get too serious about this and start getting into fisticuffs over my cartridge is better than yours is. Prove it in the field. That would be the way to do it. This is Jandy, my old trusty Sako A3 in 30-06 has always shot almost all 180 grain lead core bullets sub-minute of angle. That's a good rifle. I'd keep that one. When California forced us to go non-lead, I went with Barnes 180 grain TSX. I loved Barnes bullets for years in many different calibers, but my gun hated them. After consulting with my reloading guru friend, I loaded the 150 grain TTSX bullet and tested suggested a cartridge overall length seating my bullets 50 thousandths to 75 thousandths deeper. I think that's what he's saying here. The let's just read the numbers. 0.050 is what he seated it different. Nope, that didn't work. Oh, then he went to 0.075 inch depth seating depth. That's off the lands, guys. If you're not hand loaders, what we're talking about is you can push your bullet down into the case different distances. Obviously, they have to be pushed down far enough so that it fits your magazine and fits in the action. But if it gets out too long, the bullet's full diameter shank will hit the rifling and it'll be jammed in there. And I have seen cases where you've jammed one in and then open the action to remove the cartridge without firing it, and the bullet stays in the bore because you jammed it in there so tight it got stuck. And you can imagine what kind of pressure you get if you would fire that. Normally, you've got a little bit of room for that bullet to jump out, start moving before it hits that major block, and then starts engraving down the rifling. And that's where your pressures peak. So if you've got that thing locked in, whoo, your pressures can really pop up there. But changing the depth of it, how far back from the lands it is with different bullets changes your accuracy. Sometimes just moving it back a tiny amount like this can make the difference between 2-inch groups and sub-MOA groups. And this is what he's talking about when he's seating them deeper. So let's see what happened when he went down to 0.075 of an inch. He's now shooting 3/8-inch groups at 100 yards. There you go. Not even Barnes suggests trying deeper seating. I hope this helps someone. If I'm not an expert, but this is my experience. So thanks, Ron. Keep up the great videos. Hope all is well and stay safe. Hey, appreciate that, Jandy. So, you know, he's exactly right. But what he's saying is Barnes didn't suggest trying deeper seating. What Barnes does, though, on their website and with their bullets and stuff, is they say, start with your bullet seated 0.050 off the lands. I have not seen them say even go deeper. Generally, you start that far off and then you start extending your bullet because, as a general rule, most cartridges, most rifles, and most bullets will shoot more accurately if you get a little closer to the lands. Some bench rest shooters like to build loads in which the bullet is literally just kissing the lands and not enough for them to be get grabbed and pull off the cartridge, but just starting to kiss them. But then they work from the bottom up. They start with some really light loads because they know their pressures are probably going to be a little higher than normal because that bullet's so close to hitting the rifling. So they'll start with a light load and they'll watch for pressure signs as they work their way up with different loadings until they get the perfect combination at safe levels of pressure. Okay, dimensions of Earth. Ron, I love your videos and I'm learning much. I'm getting my first ever hunting rifle, a Husqvarna with a controlled feed action in 30-06. That ought to do the job for you. I could get a 20.5-inch barrel or a 24-inch barrel. I'm not worried about losing velocity, but will the muzzle flash and the blast be far worse on the short barrel? This is for hunting in British Columbia. Well, dimensions, I don't think I would worry about muzzle flash. I mean, I have never noticed muzzle flash to be any part of good or bad when I'm hunting. I just almost never see it unless it's at night, and then I'm not hunting because it's not legal to hunt at night. And I've never had it even, let's say, low light, you might be concerned about. By the time it goes bang flash, I'm done anyway, and I have never even noticed then, at like a half hour after sunset, that I've been blinded by the light. I can't even say that I've ever noticed it, except in videos and such. So I wouldn't worry about flash. But the blast, ooh, baby, am I worried about that. Over the years, I have contributed to a certain level of deafness by too many loud gunshots. Most of them seem to have happened in duck blinds because of the proximity of other shooters and such. But boy, the muzzle blast of center fires can really damage your hearing. I've forgotten what the OSHA safe level is for a single boom, single loud blast, something like 85 decibels or something. Well, our rifles generally put out around 140. That's a lot. And it's not a simple progression from 85 up. It quadruples or something. It's amazingly louder. And what muzzle brakes will do is increase that volume because they're blowing some of that sound back at you. Whereas muzzle suppressors absorb the sound and they can knock about 25 to 30 decibels off the top, which brings them much closer to hunter or hearing safe levels. So I would be concerned. Now, you're just doing it with length, and we certainly have noticed this. Betsy, a couple of years ago, was really enjoying a lightweight little Kimber Adirondack rifle, bolt action, in 7mm 08. And we were shooting it, getting it ready for a moose hunt. And at one point, she forgot to put her ear protection on and fired it. And her ears were ringing for a couple of days, and she says she has felt as if she's lost some of her hearing ever since that one event. But it was a 18.5-inch barrel, so it was really loud. Getting that muzzle farther away from your ears certainly can't hurt. It helps. So if you're really concerned about that, I would go with the 24-inch barrel. And since you're not concerned about losing velocity, you want that 20-inch barrel for convenience. Yeah, you can certainly get that, but then you've got to be protecting your ears. A lot of guys like to play macho and tough it out, but I think it's a silly thing to do, risk your hearing like that. So if anybody else is thinking about this short barrel versus long and you're wondering about losing your performance, because you do lose velocity with any bullet driving down a barrel that's shorter. You know, if you keep extending your barrel, you get increased velocity all the way out there into the 30, 36-inch barrels and beyond. It's amazing how far you can go and still see increases in your velocity before the drag of the friction of the bore actually starts to slow the bullet down. It's a ridiculous length that none of us want to carry around. But boy, target shooters, long-range shooters especially, will pretty regularly work with 30-inch, 32-inch barrels to get that extra reach. But for hunting, it's just not practical. So we have to sort of strike a balance. And over the decades, the balance seemed to have become 24-inch barrels for your Magnums, 7 Rem Mag, 300 Win Mag, that class. And then 30-06, 270, you start to kind of split the difference and settle, well, we could work with 22s. You don't lose that much. But if you did want to really wring out the last bit of velocity and stuff, you could go 24 or even 26 with those sizes of cartridges. But most guys have decided a 22 inch is your good all around. 24 if you really want to reach out with the magnums. And then the 20 and even 18 inch barrels now are becoming popular because of this suppressor and hearing business. A lot of guys are really enjoying having a suppressor. I'm one of them. I first started using them last year consistently. And oh my gosh, did it make me so much more comfortable while I'm hunting. In the past, I've always had this nagging in the back of my mind of, boy, make sure you're ready to put those earplugs in before you shoot. I sure hope a buck doesn't jump up. I mean, I was at the point where if a big buck had jumped up in front of me and given me a quick shot, I probably wouldn't have taken it just because I didn't want to blast my ears out. So having that muzzle brake on there, now I'm just like, I'm free again. I can go hunting, and if I get a quick shot, I'm not going to blow my ears out. So, but then you stick a 4, 5, 6, 7 inch muzzle suppressor out there on a 22 inch barrel, holy mackerel, you're getting out there. So this is the compromise. Guys are saying, I think I'm going to go with an 18 inch barrel, and I'm going to lose a little bit of velocity, but I can make up for that with my ballistic calculations, my trajectory charts and stuff. As long as I know what my drops are and my deflections, I can compensate, but I sure like to keep that noise level down. So that's a choice we all have to make at some point, I guess, but you're smart to be thinking about it and how all that works. Now, the final thing I want to say about this barrel length business is how much muzzle velocity are we losing per inch? And it varies depending on the cartridge, the size of the cartridge, the burning rate of your powders and all that. With magnums, you're probably losing a lot more than with the smaller cartridges. But as a rough average, 25 to 75 feet per second per inch, and it balances out for most of them at around 30 to 40. So you can figure, well, 30 feet per second for every inch. Just add that up and you'll get what you're going to be losing. Or if you go with a longer barrel, what you'd be gaining. Pretty good rule of thumb. All right, let's see. JMC. Ron, you mentioned the 458 Lot. What is your opinion on that cartridge being a do-it-all? The reason I'm asking is I'm trying to decide on the best caliber for a do-it-all rifle from whitetail to grizzly. Would the 458 Lot be a good choice? Or if not that cartridge, what would your choice be if you could only afford to buy one rifle? I'm not really concerned with long distance hunting. I'm thinking of maybe 200 yards or less. Thanks. Well, JMC, I got to tell you, the 458 Lot is not a good choice for an all around cartridge. It's just way too big and powerful. I mean, this thing puts out more energy in its bullets than a 470 Nitro Express. And that is a big honking bullet and cartridge used for elephants. The 458 Lot is a great elephant and Cape Buffalo choice. But boy, for anything smaller than that, it's way overkill. Now, if you like big bores and big thumpers, go for it. As a lot of guys will say, there's no such thing as too dead. And it's not going to tear up a whitetail. This is a mistaken belief that a big magnum cartridge like that will really rip up a lot of meat and stuff. And that's just not true. It's a big slug. It's not going all that fast. It's carrying a lot of energy and momentum, but it's just going to punch through. It's not going to tear things up too badly. But man, it's going to tear your shoulder up when you shoot it. There's a lot of recoil in those things. And to offset that, you want to have a heavy rifle with a pretty long barrel. You're going to have a 24-inch barrel on that thing for sure. It's not a great all-rounder. That is the one that most of us would select as that once in and every once in a while, go to Africa and hunt Cape Buffalo sort of an outfit. You don't even really need it for big bears, grizzlies and such. So what I think, if you're up in Alaska, did you say you were in Alaska? No, you're just talking about grizzly, so I kind of assumed you were. But you're going to hunt, say, North America for the biggest deer, moose, and probably some elk, and might go for a grizzly bear hunt or brown bear hunt. Those are all easily handled by the 300 magnums and even most of the 7 magnums. The trick is to get the right bullet and put it in the right place. And we always harp on that, but that really is the key. And with the 7mm these days, you can easily shoot 175 grain bullets and some 180s. You get the right one that's stoutly built. You're putting a lot of energy out there with a 7 rem mag or any of the faster sevens. And then you get into the 30s, 300 Win Mag and all the other 300 Magnums. You've got more than enough energy in those things to get deep penetration with 180 to 220 grain bullets. Or you can go with the 338. That's a great round up in the North Country where grizzlies might just suddenly invite themselves to a close-up meeting with you that you don't want. So, yeah, step down in your thinking here because that 458 lot is an absolute monster. All right. Oh, Billy here is thinking about going to Africa. Ron, I've enjoyed your videos from your hunts at Immenhof. That's an pH I use over in Africa quite a bit, as well as everything else on your channel. Just as a for your information, your videos planted the bug in my head to go on an African hunt. It made me think of my late wife's late grandfather's birthday. He was an old-time, real-deal Idaho cowboy and real good friends with Elmer Keith. It was his 90th birthday, and I asked him, "So, Pop, after 90 years, any regrets?" He said only one. He should have gone on safari with Elmer, but he was always too busy with the cows. What a story. Well, that got me to thinking that I should take his Winchester Model 54 in 270 Winchester with a Model 70 barrel that Elmer had sold him after he shot out the original. It's all notched up for all the Western big game he took with it in his life. I'd like to take it to Africa for him and to get something with it that a 270 could take cleanly. It would be amazing to add another notch or two in it for him. He was the grandfather I never had, and we made many great memories around the ranch in the few years that I got to spend with him. After a successful hunt, I wouldn't mind spending the rest of my time just sightseeing, hiking, relaxing, and telling tall tales while sipping a bourbon around the campfire, hopefully with you and other hunters. I hope we can make this work one day, and if not, I'll make my way out there alone or with a buddy. Thanks for your time and your great YouTube channel. Wow. Well, I wrote back. I said, "Well, Billy, send me photos of that Model 54 Winchester showing those streaks of notches on the bottom of the stock." I counted about 56 of them, and I asked how many deer that old hunter bagged. And Billy wrote back and said most of those notches were for moose. If you can imagine, there were some 56 or 7 notches on that thing. That old Idaho cowboy got around and had himself some great times. Nevertheless, and this is the message for all of us, he regretted that he never took advantage of going on safari in Africa. And he could have gone with Elmer Keith. Man, who wouldn't give their right arm for that opportunity? Wow. So I think the moral of that story is, guys, go while the going is good. This whole idea of, I'll wait till next year. I'll wait till I've got more money, or I'll wait till the kids are off to college and all settled in. You just never know what life throws at you. Too many times folks will do that and then something will happen where they can't go, or the country shuts down. Remember Kenya in 1976, I think it was. Kenya was the destination for big game hunting. And suddenly they had a revolution and the communists took over or something and shut it down. No more hunting. It turned into poaching paradise because all the big shots in the country were getting the money off of the poached ivory and everything else. But sport hunting, gone. So I wouldn't wait any longer than you have to go on those glory hunts that you dream about. That's what life is all about, making your dreams come true. Woo, that was a good one. You know what we might do someday is a video on that rifle. Billy and I are going to try to get together. Wouldn't that be cool? We could show you the rifle and shoot it and see how it performs. If he comes out here, he said it was his grandpa was an Idaho cowboy, so he must have some connections out here, and maybe we can get together. If not, I will at least get some photos of it, maybe do a little video showing you those pictures. All right. Now, what's this one? Something about a pickup. Oh, my gosh. Guys, you gotta hear this. "Dear Ron, I watch you often on YouTube and I'm always pleased, entertained, and informed. Great show. I am 97 years old and I still plink often. I bought my first rifle at 8 years of age. It was a Montgomery Ward's Western Field 22 long rifle, made no doubt by Mossberg. In my opinion, the 243 Winchester outsold the 6mm Remington because it was offered in the then new featherweight Winchester Model 70. I shot my second elk with it in my home state of Oregon. My first elk fell to a 270 Weatherby Magnum. So did mine. So did mine, sir. This gentleman's name is Jim. Signed it at the bottom. Jim, I shot my first elk with a 270 Weatherby too, but I didn't get a 22 long rifle when I was 8 years old. I had to wait until I was up in my teens before my mom would let me get a real gun. Oh, let's see what else Jim says here. He says, back in those days, we jumped elk out of their beds and shot them on the run. Now it's all sniper hunting, but it's still great. Keep up the good work. Cordially, Jim Warren. Wow. Now there is a special letter, folks. How often do you hear from 97-year-old hunters who are still at it? That is amazing. Jim, thanks for that one. Wow, what a treat. I wonder if that, Jim, I think you may have set a record. I don't know if anyone else has ever written in saying that they were still out shooting and or hunting at age 97. Let's have a little contest here. Who out there is older than 97? And I'm going to trust you guys. I know you could be a 20-year-old and decide to lie and say you're really 99, but we're going to trust you. Send in a little story about your hunting adventures over your lifetime, what it was like back then and what it's like now. And if you're still able to take game, I'll bet you there's somebody out there who might just outage Jim on this one, but it would sure be fun to find out. All right, let's see what the team has brought up for us here. Someone from Michigan named John. Ron, I've been looking at buying a bolt action at rifle in 308 Winchester for hunting and non-competitive target shooting. Well, that's actually a pretty good choice, regardless of what I say about the 308. There are a lot of options. At the same time, I'm looking at soon having some sons of my own shoot their great-grandfather's shotgun, which is Remington 870 Wingmaster from the 1950s. This shotgun has shot hundreds of grouse and thousands of shells while functioning flawlessly. So I'm wondering, who makes a rifle that can handle the abuse of decades of hunting like that and still be used without any replacement of parts? Do you have any recommendations? Whew. And do you think that synthetic stocks will last as long as wood? Boy, those are some good questions, John. I have often wondered about the plastics and such and how they're going to last. Obviously, these new fiberglass Kevlar carbon layups and stuff are extremely tough and durable. But plastics, how long are they going to last? You know, sometimes you'll hear, well, plastics last forever. They don't biodegrade. But then you see a lot of plastics that get the sun on them and they start to break down. Some of them get a little too hot and get a little melty and stuff. I don't know. There are epoxies in these, in a lot of these rifle stocks. How long does that stuff last? I don't know. We do know that wood lasts an awful darn long time. You know, there's plenty of hundreds of year old rifles still out there functional. The wood stocks are still great. So I don't know. You might want to just err on the side of caution and go with wood. I still love wood. I mean, I don't love dragging it through the snow and the cold and the wet, especially. I can handle cold quite easily. Actually, they feel fairly warm in the cold compared to some. But banging them up and all is always a little bit of a concern. And mostly it's the water. But gosh, look at all these old guns from way back when. How many guys still have old Remingtons and Winchesters and Mossbergs and stuff from the back in the early 20th century? Or even some old lever actions from the 1880s and before that. And they're still functional. The stocks are still good. They might need refinishing and such, but wow, they're still hanging in there. So that's what you're looking for. And I really can't tell you, honestly, if the synthetics are going to hold up that well. Really can't tell you that. But yeah, and neither can I tell you which rifles are being made now that are going to last mechanically that long. Obviously, if you figure if you pay more money for a higher quality, we've got some great inexpensive starter rifles now. But one has to question, how do they get that price down there around $300, $400? A lot of them will shoot minute of angle. But how long will they last? You know, is the extractor hook going to last long enough? Is the steel of the right quality and quantity to, or quality to hang on and pull that cartridge out time and time again? Or is something a little beefier and better quality maybe? It's just so hard to tell until you've purchased it and used it enough to find out what breaks. I do know that in recent years, a lot of these inexpensive starter guns have done that for me. Little pieces like that have broken. It's not that you can't repair them, but if you want something that's a real dynamite workhorse, I can take a licking and keep on ticking. you might want to look at some of the more expensive and or older designs. And then I'm thinking of the old, well, to me anyway, it's not all that old. I mean, the Remington Model 700 didn't come along until 1962. I suppose to a lot of you guys listening, that's pretty ancient history. But I go back to further than that. So to me, something from the early 1900s is getting a little bit old. But they were pretty rugged, like the Mausers. The Mauser 98, designed and put together for the first time and sold in 1898. And that is still considered to be one of the strongest, most dependable actions out there. Fairly heavy, beefy stuff, but I think that's part of the reason why. And then the Model 70 Winchester, based on the same concept, pretty similar and pretty beefy and heavy, but and slick. Those things just keep running and running. So yeah, I don't know what to tell you, but those are the kinds of things you need to look for. You know, the how heavy are they? How, what's the quality of the materials and all the rest of it? But I would say if you got, you know, the Model 70 still being made, and there are a lot of folks making Mausers, and the Mauser itself, the Mauser company's still out there. Rigby's making Mausers. They're real pricey. Park West Arms makes a Mauser Winchester Model 70 style controlled round feed action in the old style. That's really beefy and strong. Something like that should last for a long time too. Oh, well, good luck with whatever you pick there. I don't want to recommend something and then find out that was a bad recommendation other than what I just said. I think I can pretty much trust those to do the job in the long haul. Let's go down to Florida, in Miami of all places. Didn't know there's much hunting in Miami. Good morning, Ron. Thanks for your decades of informative, entertaining reading. Well, thank you for noticing, Todd. I have been writing for a long time. I am shooting a 270 Winchester 130 grain bullet, a muzzle velocity of 3,000 feet per second. I'd like to sight the darn rifle in so that it hits 2 inches high at 100 yards. It may be that that's the only shooting range available to me. Oh my goodness. Yeah, he is from Miami. I want the bullet to be 2 inches high at 100 yards, so what should be the point of impact at 25 yards? I welcome any thoughts you might have. Oh boy, Todd. That's a tough one because it depends on the shape of your bullet, its ballistics coefficient. It gives me the weight, but what's its muzzle velocity? Out of your rifle, that might be 100 feet per second less than mine. So I don't know that. These are the things you need to know. Now, if you get online and look for an online ballistics computer, you can figure all this stuff out yourself. And that's the best way to do it because you need to know the BC of your bullet and the muzzle velocity of your bullet and the height of your scope above the bore line. All these things are critical for 25 yards in order to maintain that at 100 and 200 and whatever else you're going to get down there. So you've got to be right on. But knowing what I do about sighting rifles in over the years, I would say you're going to be roughly a third of an inch low, 0.30 inches low, something like that, at 25, because your bore is below your sight and you have to tip that muzzle up to cross your line of sight and you're still under it at 25 yards. But then out there at 50 or so, you're probably starting to climb over it and then at 100, you maybe be 2 inches high, 2 1/4 high, 1 3/4 high. A little bit tricky there, but that should get you pretty close. So try that, and by all means, get 100 yards to double check that stuff. You don't want to just be going out hunting figuring, well, I'm a third of an inch high at 25. I must be good for 100, and if I'm good for 100 with a 270, it shoots pretty flat. I think I'll be dead on for 4. Obviously, that's not going to happen. You need a lot more information than that, but it sounds like you're going to hold your shots inside of 100 yards with this idea, and you should be good out to 100 on a deer-sized animal, no problem. You probably are good to 200 with that. So give that a try, but boy, double check it if you can. This is Peter from Nevada. I'm new to learning about ballistics and firearms. Everyone talks about velocity, ballistics coefficient, bullet size, etc., but I have yet to find anyone talk about the propellant. I know this is most likely where the secret sauce is for manufacturers, but there are some generalities that can be talked about. I read a Wikipedia article about propellants, but there is more information than I'm interested in. What I am looking for is the whys. Why are the propellants in the form they are? Pros and cons of this. Also, why are propellants not a solid state? Think of Play-Doh, for instance, or C4. Why are they in powder form? I saw some articles about experiments with rocket propellants and ammunition, et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering if you could do a video about the history of propellants, where they started, how they progressed, where they might be heading. This could be a multi-part series. There's so much information. You got that right. I didn't see anything on your YouTube channel, but is there a chance I missed it? No, you didn't miss much. I mean, we've covered some basic powder stuff in our hand loading videos. Those are on Ron Spomer Outdoors TV because we can't do hand loading on these social stations. But basically, the reason powder is powder instead of a Play-Doh, like you said, is so that you can measure it out for the precise amount. When we are hand loading, we are trickling in grain by grain sometimes to get within a tenth, at least one grain of difference in your weights and stuff, because it can make a big difference. You know, you can load up, say, 50 grains of powder and everything looks fine. And then you put one more grain of powder in and suddenly your pressure spikes and you're going to be a little bit dangerous. So you have to back off again. Shoving Play-Doh in there is going to make it a lot tougher. And it's pretty hard to meter the Play-Doh and get it inside of that. You got that narrow little case on there, even on this big 375 H&H I'm holding up. Can you imagine shoving Play-Doh down into that hole? Powder drove just pours right in there nicely. So that's why. And also powders are coated. You know, they'll come, they're made out of nitrocellulose, and some of them will have nitroglycerin added to it. And there's oxygen in the mix. And then they coat them with all sorts of chemicals that can control the burning rate. And they also will make them different sizes to decrease or increase the surface area, which changes how quickly they burn. All sorts of little scientific magic going on like that to make these powders do what needs to be done. So yeah, it is quite the science, but that's basically why gunpowders are powders. And yeah, that's probably a fair idea to do that. I don't know how many people would be wanting to watch me drone on and on about powders, but maybe if we spice it up with some burning powders. I did that on one of my videos on ROTV. I poured the powder out and ignited it to show that it doesn't explode. So many people think a gunpowder goes kaboom because you see it in the movies all the time. It goes kaboom in your rifle or your shotgun because it's contained in that tight chamber. And when you start burning that powder, it turns to a gas, and that means expansion. And where does that go? It's like blowing up a balloon and popping it out the muzzle and boom, and then you hear the big boom. So yeah, lots to do and think about with powder. But when you burn them out in the open, you will see that it doesn't go kaboom. It just burns and burns at different rates. And those rates change when it's confined as well. You don't really see it when you're out in the open air, but when you're confined, then that makes a big difference. Those are some good questions, and congratulations for thinking outside the box, because most guys never even think about that stuff. All right, we are going to Sweden now. I always like to hear from my friends in Sweden. And excuse me if I don't have that accent just right. I love talking to guys from Sweden and Norway with that accent. I kind of grew up with it in farm country. There would be some German and Czechoslovakian and Swedish. So it's just a lot of different nationalities. And the old timers still had the accents. And I just remember some fun times working with those guys on the farm and going hunting with them and trying to imitate their accents. It was a hoot. At any rate, this Eric is not an old timer from back in South Dakota. He's some younger guy, I would imagine, from Sweden. And he says, longtime listener from Sweden here. Maybe he's a little older than I thought. I hear that you frequently mention the old 6.555 Swedish Mauser cartridge, but you always get the year of adoption wrong. It was 1894. No, it was 1892. No, it was 1894. I thought it was 1892. I've read it both ways, Eric. I'll look up different reloading manuals and different things will say one or the other of those two dates. I'm thinking it was created in 92, but not officially adopted by the military till 94. Let's see what else Eric has to say about it. It was developed by a joint Swedish-Norwegian military commission and adopted simultaneously by both countries. That's the 94 I was thinking of, huh? Sweden chose it in a Mauser-style model 1896 rifle and the Norwegians in a Krag-style rifle, both chambered 6.5 by 55. In Sweden, this is still a very popular hunting cartridge, and we use it for all of our game, including moose and bears. Usually, we load it up with 156 to 160 grain round nose projectiles, and with this, it is very effective to about 200 yards. A 140 grain Spitzer is also a popular choice, but these loads need to be a lot faster to comply with Swedish hunting regulations, which requires at least 1,990 foot-pounds of energy at 110 yards. Wow. If the bullet weighs less than 155 grains. Wow, they really fine-tune that stuff. It's also easy to develop accurate loads in the 6.5/55. We get half minute of angle at 100 yards, no problem if you have a good rifle. You find an old Husqvarna 1900 with a good barrel, chambered in 6.5 by 55. You should hold it in your hands because it's one of the best hunting rifles ever made. Wow, Eric. I hope you found this Swedish perspective interesting. Best, Eric. Yeah, Eric, I sure did. Yeah, you hear a lot of great reports on the 6.5 by 55 Swede. In fact, I just got the latest issue of Sporting Classics magazine yesterday, and there's a big article in there about the 6.5 55 Swede by my friend Wayne Van Zwall. You might want to pick that up and check it out. There's also a piece in there by some guy named Spomer about modern cartridges and bullets and where we're going with our new cartridges and why. That was a little bit interesting, but probably not as interesting as Wayne's piece on the 6.5 55 Swede. Mm-hmm. All right, that looks like about the end of the road here for this trip, guys, but I do want to do a little selling here. This episode is brought to you by Ron Spomer. Hey, this is my 7mm book. We've got them for sale. You can go on Amazon, pick them up. If you want an autographed copy, happy to do that for you. Just go to ronspomeroutdoors.com website and the store. You'll see the books there. Also have some copies of the Predator Hunting book still available. That is getting long in the tooth. I wrote that book many, many years ago. Let me see when that was put out. This thing was printed in 2012, so there are. I covered all of the varmint and predator hunting cartridges up to about 270 Winchester in here, starting with the 17s. But boy, these days there are so many more that I don't have covered that I've got to update this book. But if you still want to check it out, a lot of good details in there about how to call coyotes and bobcats and what's going on and just everything I learned over some 50 years of predator hunting. I used to love to hunt coyotes. And the 7mm book is just all about 7mm cartridges. And I've got something like 46 of them in there, including proprietary ones and wildcats. It explains a lot about how they developed, when they developed, and who copied whom and all that fun stuff. So you might want to check those out. And now it's time for something special. That bell tells us it's time for our comment of the week. And it is going to, I don't know, guys, there were so many great comments this time, but I've got to give it to our 97-year-old Jim. I mean, how can you not give Jim this one? Jim, you are our comment of the week. It is so great to hear about your early exploits with the 22 long rifle when you were 8 years old, and you're still out there at age 97 shooting. That is pretty spectacular. So congratulations. You don't get a monetary award, but you get recognition for the comment of the week. And we thank you for writing in. By the way, guys, we're ringing our Second Amendment Freedom Bell made by the sculptor Doug Adams, who has got a pretty good long career already making hundreds of these bells that sell all across the country. That's just amazing. And what he's doing with the Second Amendment Freedom Bell is having me shoot the mounting plates at the bottom, shoot a little group on there, and then he signs them and offers them for sale on ronspomeroutdoors.com website. So you guys might want to jump on there if you've got someone who's hard to buy for and appreciates the Second Amendment and needs a dinner bell or something to call the kids in from the woods. This would be a good one because these things really sound off. They are made with recycled American iron. Steel, he scrounges up in old barnyards and shops and things and finds parts out of machinery and railroad ties and gun barrels. Looks like there's a shotgun barrel with a rib on this one. And his wife makes melted glass and adds those in there for a little bit of color. Really pretty special. But man, do they ever ring. Dinner! All right, guys, we'll see you next time. In the meantime, do hunt honest and shoot straight.